This Hedge School series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com. Greetings, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland Hedge School with editor Tommy Graham in the chair. And today we're looking at Fingal in the Revolutionary Decade. To what extent did the military tactics of Thomas Ashe's 5th Fingal Battalion of the Irish Volunteers in 1916 prefigure those of the IRA in the War of Independence 1919 to 1921? To what extent did the sack of Balbriggan in September 1920 provide the template for subsequent reprisals by Crown forces? To discuss the role of Fingal, North County Dublin, in the Revolutionary Decade, we're joined by John Dorney, editor of the Irish Story website and author of Peace After the Final Battle, The Story of the Irish Revolution, 1912 to 1924, and that was published by New Ireland Books in 2013. Marie Bashford-Sinnott, who is an MA in Women's Studies and is a member of Skerry's Historical Society. And finally, Frank Wearty, another member of Skerry's Historical Society and author of The Easter Rising of 1916 in North County Dublin, A Skerry's Perspective. And that was one of the excellent Maynooth Local Studies series published back in 2013. And this Hedge School is supported by Fingal County Council and the Creative Ireland Programme 2017 to 2022. Now, Frank Wearty, just to get us started, what sort of a place was North County Dublin, Fingal, in terms of, you know, population, economy, agriculture, etc.? What sort of a place was it?
Well, to begin with, Fingal is an ancient place. It goes way back in time. But when I was doing an MA thesis on the Irish Volunteers in the area, I had to define the area at the time of interest here. And the Fingal, it used to be bounded by the Talca River, but by the time of the period of interest here, townships such as Clontarf, Drumcondra, Glasnevin and Chapel Lizard had been subsumed within the city boundaries, and therefore anything north of there of those boundary lines is in what is now called Fingal. And this can be readily seen by maps of the area.
And Freddie Frank, was the name Fingal used? Because I know it's now an official council area.
Yes, it goes way back, further than I'd like to go into, but it goes way back in time. And I believe from some accounts that it nearly went as far as the bank of the north bank of the River Liffey, if you go back far enough in time. But I found, in my research, I found it problematic to call it Fingal. I called it North County Dublin, because then I wasn't getting entangled in that ancient history, if you know what I mean. And so, Irish volunteer companies, when they formed in Drumcondra and in Glasnevin and so on, they didn't need to come into my study. So I was able to. So that of the four boundaries of the county of the area of Fingal and the county of Dublin, to the north is the Delrim River. The one to the west is a meandering type of a line coming from Garlestown to near somewhere in Finglas. And then the north, the Irish Sea, of course, is the other boundary, and it has many indentations along its length from the Delrim River to Raheny, if we could call it that. So regarding the area, so Fingal, the part of Fingal that we're interested in, or North County Dublin, as I like to call it, was within the boundary, the baronies of Balruthery East and West, Coolock, and a part of Nether Cross. The people who lived there were made up of gentry families who owned the estates, mainly along the coastline. They would have been the palmers of Kenure, the tailors of Ardgillan, and there were others, of course, as well. Now, this town of Balbriggan was a special case, the town of Skerry's, beg your pardon. The town of Skerry's was a special case because It was owned lock, stock and barrel by the Hamilton family, who had bought it circa 1721 from the Earl of Thomond. And but they didn't live in the town, although they ruled it, you could say, with a rod of iron, because most of the people who lived there were tenants, town tenants, primarily within the town of Skerries. And
of course, Frank, just sorry to interrupt you there. Town tenants wouldn't have been affected by the buyout of landlords in the land in the
No, they weren't. But
that only affected rural property.
Yeah, that's right. And the Windham Act of 1903 sorted that problem out. But in Skerries, you had a town tenants league, well, a town tenants committee, which was attached to the national movement for town tenants. Patrick Matthews was secretary of it, and he was a four-man stonecutter in the Milverton Quarry. And he was one of the instigators of the Irish Volunteers when it came to Skerries, as I'll explain when you ask me the next question. But he found himself in a bit of a quandary, because he was a town tenant himself of Lord Home Patrick. The Hamiltons, there's a monument in the town of Skerries in Strand Street, the main street, in memory of James Hans Hamilton, who represented Dublin, a county Dublin, in politics in an earlier period, the 1860s, I'd say. The monument itself was raised in the 1860s to him, allegedly by his tenants, not only in Skerries, but elsewhere within the country. They had land elsewhere. Somewhere along the line, the title of Lord Home Patrick was taken by the member of that family who was in charge in the period of our interest here.
So Frank, what I'm getting from you is then there is a sort of a tension, a landlord-tenant tension, urban and rural. And if I hear you right, then you're saying that the people involved in that sort of agitation over the years, these were the people who naturally gravitated towards the Volunteers. Have I got you right on that?
Not necessarily so, because the Home Rule Bill in 1912, which was promised by the Irish Parliamentary Party and John Redmond, that was very much in vogue in Skerries. The townspeople in Skerries, by and large, it can be gauged by the fact that the newspapers carry reports of tar barrels being set alight on prominences and within the town and local prominences to highlight the fact, to celebrate the coming of the Home Rule Bill. But of course, that never came.
Yeah.
And that led to some dismay within the townspeople in Skerries was made up. They had the Hamiltons, of course. They didn't live there. They lived at Cheap Hill, and some of them lived at Abbottstown House, which was in the parish of Castle Knock.
Can I just bring Mary in here, right? Just because alongside the Volunteers, then we also had the emergence of Cumann na mBan. Mary, could you talk to us a bit about that?
Yes. My research is based on the military pensions lists of 1921 and 22. And as part of that, Kathleen MacAllister, Neil Lawless, who was the daughter of Frank Lawless, he was the quartermaster of the 5th Battalion from Saucerstown in Swords. She was involved in organising liaison between the Cumann na mBan branches and the Military Services Registration Board. She wrote that there was a huge nationalist feeling around as far back as 1900. You had the Gaelic League, Sinn Féin, the Gaelic Athletic Association, as we know. And once the Volunteers, the spirit of the volunteer movement began to, its formation in November 1913, many members of these organizations joined the Volunteers, and immediately they did so, they impressed upon their female relatives and daughters and sisters, as the case might be, the need for organizing. And that was, of course, all over the country. That's the way it happened. A lot of the families were interlinked in all sorts of ways. And So at the time, coming up to 1916, there was a fall off in membership, she said. And so a lot of the branches just were subsumed. They were almost volunteers in everything but having weapons. They did everything else. So this is her point in her letter.
So there's a marking of time between 1914 and 1916, because the volunteers split. John, they're bringing you in here because this is a prime agricultural land. And I'm assuming there's a bit of a landless labourers are an element in the social mix here. Could you talk to us about the labour angle?
Yes, Tommy. You know, it's interesting to hear Frank talk about the land agitation and the parliamentary party. And the thing to understand about that, I think, is that's the kind of previous generation of nationalist activism. So when you get to the period we're talking about, you know, you have the rise of radical separatism, and the other very powerful movement is the labour movement, which really only comes to North County Dublin in the 1910s when James Larkin organises the transport union, the ITGWU. And there's very bitter strikes in the area in 1913 during the lockout. Like, there's very serious rioting, for example, in Swords and in Finglas, which are rural villages at the time. There's over 1,000 landless labour, or agricultural labourers, better to say, on strike. You know, their conditions were pretty harsh. They had 6-hour week, they had a 12-hour day, the wages were fairly low. And in tandem with the separatist movement emerging, you also have the labour movement emerging. And while they're not the same thing, and there isn't a crossover in leadership, there is cooperation between them. So as we'll see going forward, you know, the two cooperate politically in the period in North County Dublin as elsewhere. And we're going to go on to the various events of the revolutionary period. But one thing to bear in mind is in the period after the 1916 rising, so we'll talk about the rising, but in the period afterwards with the rise of Sinn Féin, you also see the rise of the labour movement. And it's the labour movement and Sinn Féin working together that really tipped the scales, I suppose, towards revolution in 1918 when they defeat conscription. And they defeat conscription together with the general strike of 1918 and, you know, with the mass protests of that time. And that's also when the volunteers are first organised. So before that, for example, in Balbriggan, you didn't have a volunteer company and you had very heavy recruitment into the British Army. So you had 200 men recruited in plus in Balbriggan, for example, out of a population of about 2,000. You know, a lot of recruitment, really. And the tipping point where all this starts to change is 1918, where Sinn Féin and the labour movement are working hand in hand.
Sorry, John, just say there's a certain irony there given to what happens to Balbriggan later, right? But we'll come back to that shortly. Sorry, John, just before we go on to the post-1916 period, can I just go back and can you give us a recap on what happened in 1916? Because what happens in Fingal is unique, really, in the whole country, where you have a mobile guerrilla operation. Just give us a remind us of what happened in North County Dublin.
Yes, it is, Tommy. And, you know, there's lots of things you can take out of it. But one thing that is that the kind of guerrilla stuff that happened under Thomas Ashe and Richard Mulcahy happened really kind of by accident. So it's the 5th Battalion at that time. It's not a separate brigade, the 5th Battalion of the Dublin Brigade. They are sent out in North County Dublin. About 200 men came out on Easter Sunday, but most of them ended up going home. There was about 60 men really mobilized on Easter Monday, about half of whom had rifles, the rest had shotguns. And their job was to actually cut the railway lines into Dublin. Now, they tried to do that. They didn't manage to blow up the big viaduct in Rogerstown. But they ended up taking a whole series of RIC barracks. So, you know, it shows you two things interesting, I think, about the RIC, which is one, that although they're a militarized force, you know, that they're not really prepared for this kind of thing. So the barracks at Swords and the barracks at Garristown and others, they fold without a fight. Either they surrender or they leave. They go to Balbriggan, where there's a bigger barracks, and they give up their arms. So, you know, Thomas Ashe and Richard Mulcahy's men are increasingly well-armed as they go along, which is classic guerrilla stuff. But in the War of Independence itself, that really wouldn't have been possible because the countryside was so much more militarized. When they get to Ashburn, they make an attack on the barracks, and the barracks initially agreed to surrender. But then a large convoy of RIC reinforcements came along the road. So in a region of 17 vehicles, possibly as many as 100 constables, possibly 50, certainly. And Richard Mulcahy, it seems, convinced Thomas Ashe to stand and fight. So they attacked, first of all, the front of the column. And then Mulcahy, very bravely and resourcefully, led a flanking attack that attacked the rear of the column as well. There was prolonged firing over 4 or 5 hours, and there was 8 police killed, 15 wounded, and 2 volunteers.
That's a major. Several hours, right? And how many police killed?
8.
That's. I mean, that's as big as it's almost like Kilmichael proportions.
Yeah, it certainly would have been up there with the biggest ambushes of the War of Independence. And another thing about that, Tommy, is there's 2 senior RIC officers killed. There's a district inspector and a county inspector killed. You know, it's interesting in lots of ways. I mean, I don't think it is very reminiscent of the War of Independence. But one thing I'd say about it is that kind of thing, wandering around the countryside in a big column, you know, 30 kilometers, 20 miles from Dublin, would not have been possible in the War of Independence. You know, the countryside is far more militarized. And the RIC, you know, although they're armed and they are a military force, they're not really prepared for this. They haven't done anything like this since 1867, you know, in 1916.
So you're basically contradicting my introductory question. It doesn't have any effect at all. Well, a minimal effect on the tactics developed, you're saying. It's a different situation.
It's a different situation. But I mean, you know, one of the things about that is that one of the men who's so centrally involved in this, Richard Mulcahy, also becomes the chief of staff of the IRA later on. And undoubtedly, it would have influenced his thinking in terms of what was possible. Now, you know, but going back to what I said, one of the things that Mulcahy is really insistent on when he becomes chief of staff is you can't do operations bigger than are possible. So he's also aware of the limits. Where possible, you can do this kind of thing. But where you have a network of militarized police, and they're much more militarized in the War of Independence, and a military garrison, you know, it's not so easy. Now, what happened in 1916 was they successfully defeated this large force of RIC. They took their weapons. They set up another camp in Kilsallaghan, which is north of Finglas, and they waited for orders. And unfortunately for them, the orders came to Dublin from Dublin to surrender. But, you know, just on 1916 alone, it probably does show, Tommy, what was possible had there been a policy of guerrilla warfare around the country instead of this stand-up fight in Dublin. You know, they possibly could have achieved a lot more.
And the point is they were undefeated in the field when they surrendered at the end of the week. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, you know, they were increasingly well-armed from all these weapons they'd taken from the RIC. They had motor vehicles they'd taken from the RIC, and they wouldn't have surrendered had they not got orders. Yeah.
Okay, can I move the discussion back to Frank and Marie here? Frank, what effect did this have on the local community? Because we've done these county head schools before, and the common theme is that post-1916, sympathy for the executed rebels, there's a whole swing of opinion. But the difference is, in other parts of the country, you don't have sustained local armed action of this sort. So what effect did it have on you know, the rebuilding of the volunteers and coming among subsequently?
Well, in Skerries had been witness to 200 troops of the North Staffordshire Regiment having been landed on the Wednesday of Easter week to thwart efforts that were thought to be in hand by Ash, the 5th Battalion, who were coming to Skerries to knock out the Marconi radio station. Now, this apparently, this is evidence in one of the witness statements. Ash brought his band of rebels as far as Blake Cross, which is sort of halfway between Swords and Skerries, and he heard of this landing. And of course, that changed his plans and immediately ditched them and went elsewhere. Now, in Skerries, just the troops set up sandbags around the town, covering all the roads, and what do they call it when you have to have a pass to get in and out between certain hours?
Curfew.
They curfewed the town, and in addition to that, there was 2 patrol boats, because Skerries sticks out from the mainland, and in order to cover the roads into the north, which led to Balbriggan, and the other road which led to Rush, you had these 2 gunboats which were patrolling to and fro in case Ash was going to turn up. Now, this just gives a reflection of the fear that was felt by the loyalists in the town. You had one Lord Home Patrick, although he didn't live there, he would have been afraid of Skerries was his town. He didn't want to see it damaged in any way. Then you had another man called T.S.F. Battersby, who was a captain in the army, and he was home on wounded leave. And he went into a pandemonium as well. They set up first aid stations in the local Carnegie Library, and generally they lost the run themselves. So the authorities actually sent a sledgehammer to crack a nut in Skerries, because Ash, when he heard that this was going on, he came nowhere near the place. Now, of course, after the rising then, you had the roundup measures. So you had the authorities rounding up people, and you know, within the sources, you can find where the authorities were not that they weren't all that choosy about who they wanted to pick up. If it was anybody you want to get rid of for a while, they picked them up. So in the Skerries, there was 20 Skerries volunteers. I can't call them volunteers. Was there's no evidence that they were all volunteers, but there was 20 Skerries men arrested after the rising, and they were interned. Not all of them were caught in Skerries. Some of them were with Ash at the Battle of Ashbourne. One, like Matt Denham, had arrived after the Battle of Ashbourne was over, but he was there when Ash surrendered at Newbarn, just to the west of Swords there. Other Skerries people were arrested. Some of them were in the GPO. Matt Denham's brother, Joseph Denham, was in the GPO, where he had responsibility for taking the time. He was the official timekeeper. We have his watch, came from within the family. It's still within the family. So, and then there was, there was other volunteers from the area in other other garrison places in Dublin City. So,
sorry, Frank, can I bring Marie in here, yeah, right? Because Marie, I'm assuming that with all these men being rounded up, right, in the post-1916 period, that it was women who had to step up, like in terms of keeping the organisation going.
Yes, it's very interesting because, in fact, as from what I can gather, even though there were so few seemingly Skerries people involved in coming up to 1916, by 1920 there were 27 women on the list looking for pensions, which would mean that maybe you could add another maybe 20 who were within Skerries in Cumbernauld.
And this is just Skerries. That's quite a substantial number.
It is. And I think that that's very interesting. What's also very interesting, and it might come back to what Frank was saying, that some of the men on the list who went to Wakefield and all those other places and Frongoch, that they may not have been volunteers, but a lot of those men had familial, they were all related. It was amazing. Kathleen McGowan was the captain of the Cumbernauld, and her, she was the sister of, she was related to Matt and her uncles were Matt and Joseph Durham, who were very well known at the time, and then you have younger Nellie Sherlock, who was the sister of Perry Sherlock, who was killed by the Lacantins in 1920. She was the adjutant and the quartermaster at different times, and so they were very closely linked. And also Bridget Bissett, who was the quartermaster of the Skerries branch. She was related to, I think, Joe Thornton was an uncle. So there was huge, strong relationships between all those people. So, I mean, you know, it's fascinating. And also at the time, when I looked at these women, what they were doing at the time was very interesting, because you had a big hosiery and embroidery factory in Balbriggan, which was giving a lot of work out work to Skerries women. And a lot of those women on that list were hosiery and embroiderers. And I mean, it's amazing. So at least, I suppose, they had money that they could keep going,
yeah,
money coming in. And their mothers. It's an astonishing thing that so many, and the hosiery thing was very interesting as well. It didn't seem to matter, you know, you had a butcher whose daughter was a hosierer, you had a carpenter whose daughter was a hosier, and you had a labourer whose daughter was a hosier. It was really interesting that there was work for the women, obviously. And of course, there's that wonderful image that people talk about of women sitting at their doorsteps in Skerries, working on this beautiful, beautiful muslin tambour work and lace work. And so these women were there, and they were not only getting involved in looking after men, safe houses, all that sort of thing that they had done during 1916, but they were also trying to keep things together.
Now, presumably, Marie, they were heavily involved in the 1918 general election.
In the general election 1918, Sinn Féin swept the boards more or less all over the country. And Frank Lawless of Saucerstown near Swords, who was one of those interned and was one of the leaders of the in the 5th Battalion, along with Asher Mulcahy, etc. He had a large farm there, but he was a member of Sinn Féin, and he was elected as a Sinn Féin candidate. And he was also on the board of guardians of Balruthery Union at the time, which up to then was would describe it as a nationalist board. Really, he would have been an outlier in it, along with Mary Molly Adrian, who was a common man of Old Town. In 1920, she became the chairman of the board of guardians at Balruthery, and by the 1920 election, which we haven't come to yet, the local elections, the Board of Guardians of Balruthery were definitely inclined more towards Sinn Féin than they were towards the nationalist side of the law.
Now, Frank, you've mentioned the local elections. The figures I've seen for the general election was about a two to one victory for Sinn Féin over the Irish Parliamentary Party candidate. But Frank, just give us a rundown on the 1920 local elections, because these are interesting. These are the first elections conducted under PR, and of course, in this case, Sinn Féin didn't get a clear run. Just talk to us about that.
Well, I looked at as a local historian, I wasn't that interested in it really. But all I can say about it is that locally here, as regards the Board of Guardians of Balruthery, I can't be definite, but I think Frank Lawless would once again have been elected as Sinn Féin. Molly Adrian, she became chairman in that year, and she, if you read about her doings, she was definitely a Sinn Féin board by then. So I tried to find more information on it, on the local elections in 1920, which took place apparently on the 7th of June in County Dublin. But I wasn't able to add anything further to it through the newspapers.
Sorry, Marie, you want to come in there?
Yeah, can I come in there? I just have a thing about the Swords Electoral Division 1920 local elections. It's very interesting. Frank Lawless, Sinn Féin, he got 2,266 votes. And Labour, interestingly, we were talking about that, Patrick Curran, he got 1,078 votes in that
Well, maybe,
election.
John Dorney, can I bring you in here on Labour? Because it was also a general strike in 1920. And you know, we don't think of North County Dublin as a hotbed of Bolshevism, but it was close enough.
Yeah, it's funny, though, you should use that term Bolshevism, because that's used very much at the time for North County Dublin, believe it or not. You know, I mean, in my book on the Civil War, one thing I came across was that in 1923, there wasn't much of a civil war really in North County Dublin. But one thing the army people were writing back at that point, 1923, is that we're more afraid of the red flaggers than we are of the irregulars, as they call them. But going back to 1920, I mean, just briefly on the local election in Balbriggan, for example, there was three unionists elected, but there was then a coalition of Sinn Féin and Labour. So three Sinn Féin and two Labour who held the town council in Balbriggan, and they recognised the Dáil in August 1920. On the general strike, though, yeah. Again, it's very interesting because, like, what you're looking at in North County Dublin is quite a strong Labour organisation. And by Labour, I mean the union rather than the party primarily. The strike in April 1920 was in support of the hunger strikers. This hunger strike started in Mountjoy and it spread throughout the country. And the Labour movement, because Labour activists had also been arrested and interned, the Labour movement called a one-day general strike. And so the administration in Dublin Castle, led at the time really by Sir John French, gave in. And, you know, in North County Dublin, you've got great, in and around Balbriggan especially, you've got great celebrations, you've got bonfires, you have the hoisting of the tricolour by the local volunteers and Sinn Féin activists. And you have a disturbance with the RAC, a riot where the RAC tried to take down the tricolour. And this was when the first policeman was shot in the district in Balbriggan in April 1920 as well. So it goes to show the interlinking, I suppose, of the various movements of the revolutionary period. You know, it's not just a Sinn Féin and volunteers thing. It's wider than that.
Now, John, just moving on to the actual War of Independence itself, right? Now, as armed activity gathered pace over, you know, in 1919, 1920, what was Fingal's role in the overall conflict? And thinking in particular about the big black and tan depot at Gormanstown.
Yeah, like there's also quite a large British Army base in Collinstown, which is today Dublin Airport, you know, and that gets raided in 1919. Quite a lot of weapons are taken away and some of them end up in Fingal. They're not actually supposed to be, but they're kept there anyway by Michael Rock, who's a local volunteer leader. From March 1920, you know, with the RIC being expanded to include the recruits we know as Black and Tans, there's a very large depot set up at the military base in Gormanstown, which is County Meath, but it's really within the area we're talking about. And 9,000 plus recruits passed through there. You know, so there would have been several thousand at any one time, being given mostly kind of rudimentary training and police work. But these are all, as we know, former soldiers. There's also an auxiliary company based in Collinstown, and again, the site of Dublin Airport today. And this really does influence the conduct of the guerrilla war in North County Dublin, because the place is really saturated with these militarized police throughout the period.
And how do they behave? Do they behave themselves, or do they behave like they do elsewhere in the country?
Well, they behave, you know, as we do.
Leaving Balbriggan out of it just for one second.
You know, they don't do an awful lot up until Balbriggan. You know, Balbriggan is the first time when you really see them, you know, getting out of hand in the area. But before that, remember, they're not really deployed in the area. They're just training there at the depot.
And but are they out and about amongst the civilian population, though? Or are they in barracks most of the time?
You see, the guys there are being trained at the depot. They're not really they're not being deployed yet. It's still up until September 1920. Okay. It's mostly local RIC still.
Well, listen, maybe I'll go back to Frank, maybe just to give us an idea. What sort of local actions then are taking place, Frank, in the context that John has just described?
In 1920, is it?
From 1920 onwards, into 21.
Well, John mentioned the shooting of the policeman in Balbriggan. That was in May of 1920, or it might have been April, and it was early enough. That didn't bring about a reprisal as such, which is interesting because, you know, a policeman had been killed, but nobody could be actually... he was shot in the dark at night coming down Chapel Street in Balbriggan, and because it was in the dark and because it couldn't be determined who where the bullet had come from, who had a gun, there was nobody. There was a couple of local people called in, Willie Cochran and John Gaynor. They were called in for questioning, but there was no evidence. But what really set the Black and Tans off was the shooting of the chief inspector who was passing through Balbriggan in the September 20th, when he was passing through Balbriggan in a motor car along with his brother. And they called in to a hostelry in Dublin Street for some refreshments. The aforesaid Willie Cochran and Gaynor heard about it. And it was when they went to the public house, it began with a bit of an argument first, and then the two police were shot. Now, the head constable, of course, died. Now, this was what sparked off the reprisal. In my opinion, the Tans and the Black and Tans in Gormanstown were only waiting for an opportunity. They came into Balbriggan and they just didn't come with in order to gain vengeance for their two colleagues, if you like, but they went overboard, completely overboard. And this is followed up in the newspapers. It changed public opinion in Ireland, in Britain, and in America, as is well known. And then from that on, instead of the Black and Tans of the camp, the Gormanstown camp, instead of them falling back into themselves and maybe you know, having a little think, going a bit quiet, no. In October, on the 27th of October, they came over the Skerries. They came in with a big one of them big lights on there, whatever it was, a lorry or a Crossley tender, and they went looking for Matt Derham and Seamus MacDonald. And they nearly got Derham. He actually had him in their grip, but he lived in Little Strand Street. But because the place was in complete darkness, apart from this flashing light, this big light, Derham outfoxed them and got out the back, and they lost them. But in their frustration, they went up to Carbery Cottages, which is a row of about 15 labourers' cottages with no back door. They knocked on it. on the home of John Terry Sherlock, and he was inside. He should have been on the run. Others were on the run, like my granduncle Thomas Hand. He was on the run, and others were on the run. But for some reason, Terry Sherlock was there. He'd no way out. They took him down into a field nearby and shot him dead. Now, that continued on. They came back the next night and set fire to McDonald's house and attempted to take materials out of Derham's house. But in any case, Derham got such a fright, he had to go. He had to go to America. He had to get out of Ireland and go to America. How he did that, there's a story behind that. But he allegedly he went as a coal stoker from Liverpool or something, and went to New York, where he got a job in the Waldorf Astoria as a carpenter. Now, just to come on then to Bloody Sunday, which occurred in Dublin on the 22nd of November. Well, that had repercussions out here in Newark and Dublin, because the Black and Tans came to Skerries. They shot Patrick Matthews, who was the the foreman stonecutter I mentioned earlier. And then they went on to Rush, where they found John the Rover McCann. He was one of those who set the gelignite at Rogerstown Railway Viaduct in 1916. They took him out and shot him dead. His wife was in the house. He had two sons, and she was pregnant with the third son, who wasn't born until 3 weeks later. So that's the sort of thing that they were right on with.
Now, John, can I just go back to you on the sack of Balbriggan? Because in many ways, it's seen as a template for later reprisals, right? But at that stage, there was no official policy of reprisals. Sure, there wasn't.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say, Tommy, if I had to characterise it, I would say there's kind of two periods of reprisals. Now, Balbriggan is kind of the symbol. It's the centrepiece of this kind of period of very anarchic reprisals in September, October, November, December 1920, when the newly recruited police, the so-called Black and Tans and the auxiliaries, were really out of hand. You know, there was nobody was sure who was in control of them. They weren't under proper discipline. And they were kind of running riot. And, you know, that culminates in the burning out of Cork City Centre, which is Balbriggan, you know, times three or four in terms of property damage. Now, you know, the other question about it is, like, was this policy or was it just the police out of hand? In my opinion, it has the hallmarks of policy. Why? Because the reprisals are also similar. So, for example, in Balbriggan, you know, they burned down a whole street of houses. You know, people who had no connection to the shooting of District Inspector Burke. They burned down the factory. Or burned down a hosiery factory.
John, just to say to you, they destroy the economy of the town, essentially, don't they?
I mean, that's what I'm saying.
So, they wreck the place from top to bottom.
Exactly. So, like, in rural towns, what they're doing is they're burning the, you know, the mainstays of the local economy. Like, typically in Munster and in Connacht, it's the creamery they burn down. It's collective punishment, really, is what's happening. And what the Labour Commission, the British Labour Commission to Ireland, you know, which is really responsible for publicising Balbriggan, especially, but also others, it says is this is collective punishment on people who had no part in it in the initial attack. And they also make the point that, you know, Hammer Greenwood, who's the Chief Secretary of Ireland and the government of Lloyd George, say that, well, the Sinn Féiners, as they call them, are just murderers and they're the unproductive people, they play no part in the economy, they're corner boys, they use these kind of terms. And the Labour Commission says, but these reprisals are actually destroying the very economy that you're talking about. They're destroying the businesses of Ireland. So Balbriggan is very bad, but it's quite typical of a whole spate of reprisals, particularly starting in September 1920, which to me have the hallmarks of policy. They're covered up in the House of Commons by Hammer Greenwood and others. One or two people like MacCready, the military commander, didn't like them, but nobody gets punished for it either. Now, just to finish my point, there's a second wave of reprisals in 1921, which are quite different, because especially in Munster, because martial law is declared and you have official reprisals where the military goes in and they just blow up your house. You know, it's a bit different. But, you know, I guess the result is the same.
Frank, you wanted to come in there?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, I left out my granduncle, who Thomas Hand, who was a fairly influential Irish volunteer in Skerries. He was a member of Sinn Féin. He was in the IRB along with Matt Derham. He was secretary of the Irish National Foresters, and his wife got money from them when he was interned in Frongoch. But anyway, his turn to be killed came on the 5th of December 1920 when the Tans arrived. He was on the run, so he was, you can imagine the winter time, the coldness and the darkness, the winter, where did they go to hide? But anyway, he went to his former parental home where he grew up. His mother and father were dead, but his brother and two of his sisters, his brother Charles and two sisters, Rose and Bridget. Now, Bridget was my grandmother, but they shot him. He tried to get out a little window at the side of the house. They shot him dead, 4 bullets apparently. Now, the Irish Independent on the 7th of December carried a representative went out there, and they carry a very vivid account of what happened to hand up Baltrasna Lane, which is to the north of Skerries. It's down a lane on a headland overlooking the Irish Sea. And unless the Tans were guided there by somebody who knew the layout of the place, you couldn't see the house from the road. It was only a cottage in the corner of a field. But in any case, his brother gave an account. My grandmother, Bridget, gave an account. And like my grandmother was only 24, her sister was only 20, and Charles was older. They gave this account of being, you know, of going out into the lane when the Tans made their exit. They went as fast as they came, apparently, once their deed was done. And they, you know, I grew up, I was the eldest grandchild in my house. I spent many a time with my grandmother because I was sent up there most Saturdays or Sundays. She never mentioned, she never told me anything about it. They had a small farm. Her two sons were my uncles. They on occasion brought me over to that the field where a hand was shot. They never said that the ruins over in the corner, that's where your grand uncle was shot. They never mentioned, never even mentioned it. So there seemed to be they seemed to want to forget it. Maybe that may have been the reason for that, but. And so I just wanted to add that because I had forgotten him. He was killed in December. So we're nearly into nearly into 1921 at that stage.
Yeah. Marie, can I just go back to you on the effect of, you know, the sack of Balbriggan and other reprisals? Like, did it help or hinder subsequent IRA activity?
Well, I'll tell you the thing about, and I'm talking about mostly about Cumann na mBan. That was my interest, and that was where I really know a little bit. But I really know a very little about the Cumann na mBan people and women in Skerries, because when I began to look at them to try and get people, as to just reflect on what Frank said, to get people to talk, Tommy, was almost impossible. It was really interesting because one man said, "Oh no, we don't talk about my mother. No, we don't talk about her." And I said, "Well, you know, I'll be giving the talk. It's in the public record, and I'll be mentioning her." I was looking for a photograph. So he said, "Well, that's okay." But then when I actually gave the talk, and this is reflecting, I never got such a hug from anybody in my life. And he said to me, "I'll have that photograph for you." It was like as if almost people have to be allowed to be proud of the work the women did. And we know that there was all sorts of things happened. They were excommunicated. They were told that they were unmanageable revolutionaries. They were told they were harridans and furies. So a lot of that came to bear on women, I think. And I'm just looking at the women in Skerries, and I'm just taking that as the example of my experience of trying to get information. That information is beginning to gradually come as more scholarship is done and more people are academically looking at things. But it was a very, very interesting experience and quite an emotional one for me, because I had people coming, and one girl didn't know that her grandmother had been Nellie Sherlock. She knew her Nellie Sherlock. She didn't know that her grandmother had been the adjutant in the local Cumann na mBan. And that was Terry Sherlock's sister. You know, it was just... it was as if people wanted to forget or were made to forget or something was going on. And it's interesting. And hopefully in the future, we'll find more reasons why these things were not spoken of. As you say, Thomas Hand, I mean, they should have been so proud of him. And yet they kept quiet about it. And where did that come from?
Well, that's an interesting point you raised there, because I mean it is gratifying, because it means that there are several more untold stories out there yet to be told, you know.
Huge amount.
And I think with the opening up of new archives like the the bureau and the pensions files, that it fills in the gaps, like and will allow people to come forward.
I had hoped to do, and I will do more, but I'm working on a biography of a woman, a Dublin writer. She was very involved in the War of Independence and the Civil War, Annie M.P. Smithson, and her story isn't told. And I'm trying to do, so I'm hoping to go back, you know, to my society, to write in the papers. But it will be fascinating to kind of try and talk to people that I have made some bit of connection with and go back to them.
Frank, did you want to get in there?
Yes. Sorry, I just wanted to add, I did a biography of Terry Sherlock. One of the, Marie's talking about Nellie Sherlock there. Nellie, the family got such a fright after Sherlock was shot. He was only about 22. That Nellie went to New York. Now, Terry Sherlock was interesting in the sense that he had two brothers in the British Army, James and Joseph. Now, James went to New York at some point. Joseph was all over the world with the world with the British Army. He was in Mesopotamia and all the rest of it, and retired on good terms from the army, and then went back to live in Number 7 Sherlock, which by then had been named Sherlock Terrace. And with Thomas Hand, there was Thomas Cross Street, which changed to Thomas Hand Street. That happened in the 1920s. But the name Sherlock on the doesn't occur now in Skerries because the two brothers, as I said, one of the brothers, James, went to New York. Nellie went to New York, and then some of the members that I was in contact are now to be found in Tempe, Arizona. The family, emigrated within the United States. So, some of them had already been in New York, but Nellie probably would have stayed here, but for the fact that her brother was killed and the trauma of it. Terry Sherlock's father, for example, his way of dealing with the trauma was to go over to Shenanigans Island, which was leased out at the time to a local man farmer, and he hid over there for a period of time. He couldn't deal with it back at home, back in Skerries with his family. Such was the trauma that because it was him and his sister, it was possibly Nellie, him and Nellie, that found the body of James Sherlock, or Terry Sherlock, in the field, riddled with bullets. A local person by the name of Fox, a woman, she came along as well. She mopped up the blood of Terry Sherlock's, mopped the blood from his body, and that in a handkerchief. And the handkerchief was in a local butcher shop owned by the Foxes for years and years afterwards. It's now in the archive of the Skerries Historical Society. And if you were to see that handkerchief, it's very traumatic to see it, because that's Terry Sherlock's blood that's now dried into the handkerchief.
Yes, and can I add something there? Una Fox, she was only 12, she told me, that happened. She was only 12, and I knew Una a little bit. Her family, her brother was Willie Fox, am I right?
Yes.
Willie, she told me that we were in the house one day, and she brought us out to the door, and she said there was a big cross behind the door, and she said, "You see that cross? My mother put that up when the tans were around," she said. And one night, and it may have been after around that time, she said that the tans were around looking for people. My brother Willie was up in the bed, and we couldn't let him. He couldn't get out. He was upstairs. And she said, and my mother prayed, and we all prayed, and she said, the tans never came near the door. You know, these heard their apocryphal stories. I don't know what they are, but they're important stories, tell you the feelings of the time. And she also told me that when she was a little girl around the same time, she was down the back of her house, and the local RIC, when the RIC came along, and said, "Hello, how are you? Blah, blah, blah." And she was chatting. And he said to her, "Did you ever see anything strange around the back there? Did you ever see anything like maybe a gun or anything like that?" And she said, no, I saw nothing like that." But she said, "I had seen it. I knew where it was," because she said, kids know where things are, you know. And all those stories are so important, I think, because it gives an idea of a little young girl, you know, she had all the whole, almost a blood sacrifice thing when you think of what she did by the sacred blood of Terry Sherlock. I find that very, very moving and possibly almost over the top. But those times, things were very, very over the top. And there was a heightened sensibility about religion and about nationalism and about the rights of man. There was all sorts of stuff going on. It's an amazing time. And I think a lot still has to be done, and particularly a lot has to be done about women. I know that Terry Frank has done wonderful work for Scariest Historical Society and with his MA over in Maynooth. But I think that there's a huge amount of scholarship to be done, I think, on women.
Well, tell you, Marie, there's going to be several more hedge schools on this. And by the way, we haven't even gone into the period of the Civil War because we're holding back on that. But I'm just looking at the time here, and I might go to John Dorney. Just going back to that Bible we've been using, several hedge schools now, the Dead of the Irish Revolution. Where does County Dublin feature in the league table in that particular publication?
You know, the body count is not all that high. Like, there's a very testy correspondence between Richard Mulcahy, who by this point, as I said, is a former member of Fingal Unit, but by 1920-21, he's the chief of staff of the IRA. There's a very testy correspondence between him and Michael Rock, who's the head of the Active Service Unit, which is formed in late 1920 in Fingal. Now, the thing is, like you alluded before there, Tommy, to what effect does the sack of Balbriggan and the ensuing kind of spate of shootings have? You know, a lot of men had to go on the run, and you know, they formed an active service unit, a flying column, and they had arms which were taken from the raid in Collinstown. But they claimed the countryside was too flat, there was too many police and too many troops, which would possibly correct in the area. But to answer your question about the body count, Richard Mulcahy wrote to him, in this enemy-infested area, there's only been 5 enemy killed and 13 wounded. And he said this is negligible in terms of the country as a whole. He was extremely critical. And Michael Rock asked him for more arms to be sent from the Dublin Brigade. Mulcahy said, no, not until you show me that you're prepared to use them. So, you know, Mulcahy was a very hard boss. I wouldn't have liked to have had him as a boss. You know, he writes that your reports are shoddy. You know, they're not up to scratch. But, you know, what he's asking people to do is actually very difficult. You know, so Rock planned a number of big actions. He planned on ambushing the auxiliaries at the train station. He planned, interestingly, to put typhoid into the water supply of Gormanston Camp. But Mulcahy turned him down. He said, that's, you know, that would be terrible for publicity.
We had a piece on that in History Ireland, actually, last year. You know, the use of germ warfare, it never happened, thankfully, right? But it was discussed. Yes, yes. Yeah. So what was the state of play then at the time of the truce, John? And what sort of state was the IRA in County Dublin?
Well, you have a parallel, though, to a lot of kind of rural areas, which is that, yeah, the IRA still exists, which is the big thing for a guerrilla organization. There's quite a well-armed active service unit or flying column. They have around 20 rifles and they have a machine gun, a Lewis machine gun. So, you know, it's not enough from a conventional military point of view, but it's plenty to cause an awful lot of trouble. And they still exist as a thing. They're still capable of, you know, carrying out sniping attacks, small operations, assassinations. The area is absolutely flooded, though, by this point, you know, with armed police and with military. So, you know, it's quite similar. The state of play is quite similar. Yeah. The thing about the War of Independence, to the rest of the country, it's quite similar, sorry. The thing about the War of Independence and the way it ended is, you know, that it didn't come to any military decision. You know, it was still in the balance at the time of the truce. The British military are telling their government, look, we need much more drastic measures if we're going to win this thing. So, you know, it ends before it reached any sort of military conclusion, Tommy, really.
Right, okay. Listen, guys, we're going to leave it there. Fascinating discussion, and we will be back to this neighbourhood, as I say, to look at the Civil War. Our next two hedge schools next month will be, first one will be Kenmare, History and Survival, Father John O'Sullivan and the Famine Poor. That's a book by Colin Kenny. So Colin will be talking to me about that. And then the next hedge school after that will be on prisons and prisoners during the War of Independence. So I'd just like to thank our panel here today, looking at Fingal in the Revolutionary Decade, John Dorney, Marie Batchford-Sinnott and Frank Wearty. And I'd like to thank you listeners for tuning in, and I hope you tune in again. Thank you very much.